Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Writer Marlo Starling will join us to talk about her recent article in Deseret Magazine titled Consider the Condor. She writes, once on the brink of extinction, the bald, feathered symbol of the West is making a promising comeback. If only we can get the lead out. We'll also talk about other recent articles titled Inside Florida's Ban on Lab-Grown Meat, How Do Cats Land on Their Feet, and Do Animals Really Have Instincts? We'll revisit our conversation with writer Marlo Starling following the news.
This episode of Access Utah was originally broadcast in July.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Writer Marlo Starling is joining us today to talk about her recent article in Deseret Magazine called Consider the Condor. She writes, once on the brink of extinction, the bald, feathered symbol of the West is making a promising comeback. If only we can get the lead out. We also will talk about other recent articles titled Inside Florida's Ban on Lab-Grown Meat, How Do Cats Land on Their Feet, and Do Animals Really Have Instincts? Marlo Starling is a freelance journalist based in Brooklyn and Miami who writes about climate, conservation, and culture. Her work has appeared in The New York Times, CR Magazine, Deseret Magazine, Mongo Bay, The Margerie, and more. She has a master's in science journalism from New York University. This article appears in the June 2024 issue of Deseret Magazine. You can find it right now at deseret.com, and you can find Marlo Starling at marlostarling.com. Marlo Starling, pleasure to welcome you to Access Utah. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
So a lot of interesting topics that you write about. I guess, first of all, this is a nice career. How'd you get into this? Graduated master's in science journalism, and do you just choose your topics, or do you have editors who assign you?
It's a little bit of both. Thanks for asking. I've been studying journalism since high school, actually. So I've been in this career for a while at this point. I studied journalism in undergrad as well. And it was there that I realized, wow, I really love wildlife and ecology. I took some wildlife classes in undergrad and didn't really realize until then that science journalism itself is a thing. And I think a lot of people, when they hear that term, they go, oh, what's that? So definitely a unique side to journalism, but my work focuses predominantly on climate and environment, as you've seen from my body of work. It's great because I have the freedom as a freelancer to choose most of the stories that I work on, but occasionally I'll have an editor reach out and say, hey, we've got this really cool story. Do you want to work on it? And usually the answer to that is yes, because I tend to be excited about a lot of different topics. And that was the case with the condor story, actually. I jumped at the opportunity to write about one of the most iconic conservation stories in history, was already vaguely familiar with it, and was really excited to write this feature for Deseret.
So you begin the article, explorers and settlers couldn't agree on whether they beheld beauty or the beast. So described as a handsome bird or a huge monster. Let's start with your description of a condor. For those who haven't seen a condor in the wild, describe it.
Oh, yeah. Let me tell you, it is. I had scientists tell me before I went out to see them for myself how magnificent they are. And truly, they are just like the most majestic creatures in the sky that you can possibly see. I mean, one of the biggest birds on the planet, prehistoric looking. I mean, that's one of the first things that comes to mind when I see one, is just they look like dinosaurs. And they are pretty much dinosaurs. You know, they were around during the Pleistocene when there were other, megafauna that we don't have anymore, roaming around. And so it's really cool to me to think about how prehistoric and old they are, how long they've been on this planet, much longer than we have. But they're also kind of beautiful. And I think when people think of vultures, they think of this ugly, grotesque, creature that's eating dead meat. But they're kind of beautiful in their own right. They're funky looking. I think I describe them as looking like, the tufts of black plumage, like a like the fur on like a fur coat on an elderly woman, because they have these wrinkly, faces. But there's beauty in that, right? And they've also got all these different colors on their head, and these beautiful white, feathers underneath their wingspan. So when you see one flying overhead, that's how you can know that it's a condor and not any other vulture or bird, in part because of their size. They're so huge. But just watching them fly, I mean, they glide through the air. It is amazing to see one fly overhead, especially, and you can hear the wind in their feathers. I amazingly got to experience that for myself when I was in Arizona. So yeah, I mean, to me, they're just majestic, beautiful creatures, but I am also a wildlife person, so I might be a little bit biased there. But even when I was out there and seeing tourists see, condors for the first time, they all said the same thing. They went, "Wow, that's such a," I heard things like, "What a beautiful bird." I heard kids go, "Wow, that's a pretty bird." We have these preconceived notions of what a vulture is and what it looks like and what its role is in the ecosystem, but it's really very misconstrued from popular culture and media and some of these descriptions, that contradict themselves in the literature going way back to a couple of hundred years ago.
So, are condors in a class called vulture, or is that term interchangeable? Condor, vulture.
So all condors are vultures, but not all vultures are condors,
Okay.
if that's
Yeah.
helpful to think about it that way. Yeah.
Yeah. They mostly glide, do they?
Yeah,
Huge
they don't
wingspan.
huge wingspan. They don't have to put much effort into the actual flying process once they're in the air. I mean, they've got to get themselves up and they can weigh up to 26 pounds. So getting 26 pounds in the air effortlessly is no easy feat, which is why when they're chicks and juveniles, flying is literally something that they have to practice. Like they have to practice, taking off and flying through the canyons. And we saw some of that ourselves when I went and joined some scientists out in Arizona. But yeah, once they're in the air, they kind of they're super aerodynamic. They're able to kind of just shift the position of their wings a little bit in order to, accelerate or go up, go down. And it's really amazing to see that because they're not, like your standard bird, any other bird that you want to kind of conjure up, you'll see it flapping to keep itself up. But a condor really is not doing much of that once it's in the air. It's just kind of like a paraglider, which is pretty amazing.
So you talk about condors are symbols of death and resurgence. Death, we understand, they scavenge, right? They eat dead meat. If you see condors circling, then there's maybe something dead on the desert floor. Resurgence, I guess, because 1982 there were just 22 condors left in the world. 22 in the world.
In the world, California condors, we should
Yeah, California
specify. There's
condors. Yeah.
also an Andean condor in South America. So for anyone listening, yes, there is another type of condor out there. But yeah, the California condor got down to just 22 total in the world, which is a pretty stark. And that's when this very, in my mind, heroic effort began to recover the population, because at that point, scientists realized if we don't do something, if we don't step in at this point, we could very well see this population go extinct. And which is why it's pretty amazing that I found some historic records showing that even back in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, there were some scientific literature accounts of, scientists saying it's quite possible that we will see this bird go extinct even back then. And so this was 1982, of course, that it got down to that number. And that's when scientists went ahead and took them all out of the wild. They went through a process of capturing them and bringing them into captivity and started a captive breeding program. And so a captive breeding program is not specific to the California condor. This is a technique that's been used for the conservation of other raptors, so birds of prey, and other species beyond birds, where you breed those animals in captivity. Raise them partially in captivity, but with very minimal human interaction so that they're not getting accustomed to humans. And eventually they're released back into the wild. That way, you're, keeping the population afloat because the population cannot sustain itself or increase on its own. So that started in 1982, and that program is still alive today because the population is still not considered self-sustaining. Today, there's about 560 birds total in the world that exist. That estimate includes both free-flying wild condors, as well as those that are in captivity in the breeding program, are still not ready for release yet. So it's made, a decent amount of progress, of course. 560 is much better than 22, but still the population is still struggling enough that that program is really necessary to keep the population as a whole alive.
So, understand from your article, there are predators, vehicle collisions, electrocution from power lines, I guess forest fires. The big problem, though, is lead bullets, though, right? That's the huge problem. Tell me why.
Yeah, so lead is killing half of all the diagnosed deaths of condors annually. So what that means is there's condors that are recovered that have died. Half of those that are recovered were killed by lead poisoning. So why? How is that even possible? People are not shooting condors, right? Because that's highly illegal. They're an ESA, Endangered Species Act listed species. But because they are scavengers and they only eat dead animals, you will never see a condor try to kill a live animal. I think that's another misconception about condors because they're so massive and, impressive looking, but they only eat dead things. What happens is when there's a lead bullet that's inside of the carcass of an animal, it's very easy for a condor to go and feed on that carcass and get lead poisoning. So just like lead is bad for humans, there's no amount of lead that is safe for human beings, or other animals. Condors are susceptible to that toxicity from lead because lead is a toxic substance. And lead specifically is bad not only because it's toxic, but because the lead bullets spray out into the carcass of an animal when it enters the carcass. So instead of just kind of retaining its shape, it sprays out into hundreds to thousands of tiny little shards. And the Peregrine Fund, which is a nonprofit organization that is heavily involved in condor conservation and the conservation of other birds of prey, they've done demonstrations showing how this works using water barrels and ballistic gel, which is like this clear jelly-like substance that shows how much those lead bullets really spray. And most hunters, shooters, ranchers, anyone who is used to shooting a gun into live animals, a lot of people don't know that until they see that and they go, "What? Like I never even realized that that's what's happening." And because it's spraying out that way into these teeny tiny tiny shards, it's virtually impossible for a condor to avoid those tiny shards when it's feeding on a carcass that's been shot with a lead bullet. And it only takes, as one of my sources said, Myra Finkelstein, a toxicologist, environmental toxicologist, she told me that it only takes as small as a grain of sand to, contaminate a condor. And the condors, despite that, are pretty, they're pretty tough. I mean, there's condors that are living out there and they've got very high levels of lead poisoning in their blood. So, I mean, it's killing them, but it's also they're surprisingly, some of them are really like sticking it out despite those levels. So
You talked with one person trying to change people's minds. Where we fail is not the science. He said, we fail in talking about what the implications of our findings are. I guess they're trying to get the word out about switching to copper bullets. Not a whole lot of success so far.
So there has been a decent amount of success, actually. I mean, I love that quote from Chris Parrish, who's the CEO of the Peregrine Fund, because he's both a hunter and a conservationist. And he tells me how he introduces himself kind of depends on the audience, because unfortunately there has been this rift that has been created over the decades, not just with condor conservation, but other aspects of conservation between, environmentalism and the hunting and ranching community. And one of my main goals with this story was to avoid that, right? I think there's been so much misinformation that's created this unnecessary rift when really the two can be one and the same, as Chris Parrish is. But that quote is great, I think, because it really speaks to the fact that how we communicate the science is really important. And if the science is being communicated in a way that is ostracizing an entire community of people, that's not going to be very effective. But the program that he and others have kind of collaboratively introduced to help, it's called the Non-Lead Ammunition Partnership, and it is directly geared toward any community of people that is routinely, shooting guns into animals, whether it's or shooting, I'm sorry, bullets into animals, whether it's hunting or ranching or predator control is another really common one that people don't think about. Anybody who is doing that, it's important to educate them on here's why a copper bullet or any other non-lead bullet is better than a lead bullet. And these days, there's not really a huge price difference between the two. And so they've had a decent amount of success actually in helping those communities switch to copper bullets. They've had about 90% participation rate in that area in Arizona and Utah that have started to comply with that voluntarily. And it's really interesting because in California, meanwhile, which is where the other flocks of California condors live, there's a ban in the state of California on lead ammunition. And they've actually found that that is not any more effective than the voluntary program in Arizona and Utah. So it's interesting to see two different approaches to trying to reduce, lead ammunition use, kind of end up in the same place. Despite the success that there's been in Arizona and Utah, for helping people, voluntarily switch to using copper bullets, there's still enough lead out there for it to be the number one cause of death for condors. So that's a little bit perplexing, of course, but it does seem like those efforts for voluntary switching, to copper bullets have been really effective so far.
My favorite part of your story, along with condors, is the condorks. These are people who love condors, right? I love that name. One of them said, "The problem with condors is they hook you. It's not hard to fall in love with this species." Why did they say that? What makes them fall in love with this species?
Yeah, I mean, I wish they could answer this themselves because it's such an amazing group of people that I felt very lucky to be able to spend time with. That was Tim Houck, who is also with the Peregrine Fund and has been in condor conservation for like 2 decades at this point. They are such personable birds. And this is one aspect that, I mean, I could have written double the amount that ended up in this story. And one of those aspects that I loved was hearing so many different scientists who are involved in condor conservation talk about how relatable they are to humans. And so I think that's a big part of it is, even though it's this prehistoric bird, birds and humans, we don't necessarily think of birds and humans being similar. We might think of, humans and primates being similar, of course, evolutionarily, but these condors are so like goofy, they, people have observed them kind of like teasing each other, and the way that they raise their young is also, I think, relatable to us in a way. They only raise one chick at a time, and the both parents stick together as they're raising that chick. They take turns caring for it. So there's a lot of aspects to their personalities, oddly enough, that I think make them really charismatic and easy to fall in love with. I mean, when you're spending these scientists spend all of their time with the condors, whether it's in captivity at a zoo or whether it's in the wild, the way that the Peregrine Fund operates with them. And of course they're a big part of the wild releases that happen. So they're really seeing them from, they're from youth to adulthood, and then they continue monitoring those birds for years and years and years after they release them. So, when there is a bird that's recovered that has passed away, it's really hard on them because they invested so much time. They invested their entire careers into trying to recover this population, and any loss is a big loss when the population is that small. So I think those are a few of the reasons why. I'm sure there's many more, but a few of the reasons why it's so easy for these scientists to become attached, and they're so passionate about what they're doing.
Let's take a brief break here and we'll continue the conversation on the condor. We're talking with writer Marlo Starling. You can find her at marlostarling.com. We're talking about a recent article in the Deseret magazine called Consider the Condor. You can find Deseret magazine at deseret.com. This article was in the June 2024 issue of Deseret magazine. We'll have more following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with the writer Marlo Starling. She's a freelance journalist based in Brooklyn and Miami, writes about climate, conservation, and culture. And she has an article in the June 2024 issue of Deseret magazine called Consider the Condor. We're talking about this magnificent animal today. You can find this article at deseret.com. You can find Marlo Starling at marlostarling.com. So Marlo Starling, I was interested in, there's interesting visual that you conjure up. These condorcs, they're going to examine some condors, and they tell you, we're going to look foolish for a little bit here. This is a big animal. My favorite image is when you're going to weigh a condor, I guess you awkwardly hug the condor and you sit on a scale with the condor.
Yes, this was one of my favorite parts of the field reporting for this story. So I'm glad that you're asking me about it so I can share more details with all the listeners out there. But yeah, they're very down to earth people too. But yes, Tim Houck warned me that they're going to look a little bit foolish chasing around condors. Basically, this entire scene, what I was watching was something really special. This only happens a few times a year, if that. And 2024 is a busier release year than normal. Their slogan, which this did not end up in the story, but their slogan this year is 24 for 24. They're trying to release 24 birds this year. And so this was the second batch of the year that they were releasing birds. And they do that four at a time. So what I was watching was them trying to capture four birds, transform their what's called the flight pen. And capture just means put them into giant dog kennels, basically. And then the coolest part was that they take those dog kennels on these ATVs and drive them to the release pen, and they have to transfer them to the release pen. And this is all, again, with very minimal human contact. These, you know, the dog kennels are you know, blinded so that they don't get freaked out by anything. And that's when they also run their health checkups on the birds. And then once they're done with that process, they put them into the release pen, where about a week later they would release them into the wild. So it's a whole acclimation process, basically, so that they're doing everything, you know, the correct way, so that the birds aren't just there. There's a whole science to it. But the process of that you're describing with them weighing them is really incredible, because, and that's where I got to see the birds up close in a way that most people will never be able to. What they do is they take them one by one, bring the dog kennel into one room, open the kennel, have to find a way to wrangle that bird into their arms, basically, and exactly the way you described it, in an embrace. So, and these are big, these were juvenile condors, but they're still massive. I mean, massive birds, and some of them weighed already over 20 pounds. So that's a big, you can imagine, you know, how awkward that is, having to hold this bird that does not want to be held, is not used to human beings holding it. And it is probably the only time it will ever have a human holding it. So the first step is to bird in arms, take it over to a scale, stand on the scale, get the measurement as quickly as possible. And then that biologist would walk over to a chair that's set up. They sit down in the chair, they're still cradling the bird. And of course, there's a special technique to, you know, keeping like two fingers, like your index finger and your thumb, over the beak so that it doesn't basically attack the hell out of you, because these are really strong birds and they're not used to this. And then that's when they run their physicals. They take blood samples for later on, which is really important for testing up their baseline lead levels, because some of these birds are unfortunately born with lead in their blood already. That's how prevalent it is in the population. So those blood samples are really important for taking a baseline test. And then they also give it its new wing tag. So each bird that's released into the wild has a wing tag that happens during this process, so that they can easily identify who's who and keep track of the entire population, which is a pretty incredible effort. And then once all of that is done, they take it into another room separately, let it go into the release pen, and then it can acclimate and get used to its new surroundings. And once that happens, this is like a huge like gated pen, right? That's on the side of this cliff essentially. And it was really cool because once that happens, the existing free flying condors come over. They're curious and they come over and see the new guys that are in the pen, and kind of you can tell they're kind of checking on them, going, "Hey, who's this guy?" And then eventually, those younger condors will join them in the wild about a week later. But yeah, pretty incredible process to see them up close like that. And I like looked into the eye of one of these condors, and they've got these red eyes, which is really either cool or creepy, you decide. I thought it was cool, but just incredible, incredible creatures. And their feet too are like these giant chicken feet, like just dinosaur looking. So yeah.
It was touching to me to see the love, the care that these scientists have for them. So you have a scene where they're releasing some of these condors. Hopefully condors will be successful out there. One of these young condors perches in a not a great place, right? Vulnerable to predators, etc. And the scientist is trying to get him to move. A protective instinct, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they have this whole there's a process in conservation biology called hazing, which sounds worse than it is. All that means is that they are basically training the birds in this case to not make themselves vulnerable to predators or to other threats. Because when you're raised in captivity, you kind of have to help them learn what they would learn otherwise in the wild. So that's kind of one of those ways of making sure that the birds are surviving and learning what they need to learn in order to survive in the wild on their own. And that process can be kind of funny, right? So one of the biologists will usually stay up top where these birds are perching and basically mimic a predator in any way possible. So if it lands in a bad spot, they time it appropriately and then will kind of come up and like, yell or wave their arms or anything to like scare them off so that it helps teach them that they should not land in a spot like that. And that can be like on the ground, for example. You never want to see a condor on the ground. That makes them very vulnerable. Any spot that like a coyote could come up and sneak up behind it, things like that to help them recognize, oh, this is not good. I will never do this again.
This was a striking quote. When the scientist says, "We're learning as we go. Nobody who's alive has ever seen a healthy population." So we did, in one way, a great success story. We went from 22 in the entire world to several hundred now, right? But it still is an unusual and wonderful sight to see an untagged condor, right? That means that they actually were bred in the wild. What do these scientists tell you? What are they hopeful? They'll see a viable, healthy population at some point.
Totally, yeah. No, they absolutely are. I mean, they've been helping these condors out for decades at this point. And so yeah, they are hopeful and they do think it's possible. It's possible, especially if the lead poisoning issue does not become as much of an issue. And notably, and this was another hopeful point that resonated with me a lot. The work that toxicologists and population modelers have done, over the past 2+ decades, have shown that it really won't take much for that to happen. It doesn't take much of a reduction at this point in lead poisoning in order for to kind of like tip the scale, so to speak, for the population to grow instead of decrease or stay stagnant. So that's the good news. As long as we can continue efforts to reduce the use of lead bullets and lead poisoning, in condors, that will help the overall population eventually. It just that's really kind of the linchpin in all of this. But yeah, it's that was I met up with Steve Kirkland with the Fish and Wildlife Service when I was in California, and we drove out to Bitter Creek National Wildlife Refuge, which is a beautiful, beautiful place, and a terrain that, as a Floridian, I'm very unfamiliar with. So it was very cool to see that habitat that condors inhabit in the mountains. And we were talking about how there really isn't like a baseline population number that scientists have. You know, normally, you know, if there's available data, scientists are able to assess, okay, here's what a healthy population does look like, here's what we want to get it back to. But scientists really don't have a good idea of what that number looks like because they were so low for so long. And, you know, science back in the 1800s was not what it is today, and there was never, you know, an accurate population count. But we do know from some of those historical accounts that there was a significant number of them at one point. And from you know, some of the other historic data from fossil, you know, fossil records down in Florida, fossil records up in northern British Columbia, you know, so we have an idea of how widespread they were at one point, but there is really a huge gap in that knowledge, which is why it was significant. When I was with Steve Kirkland in California, we ran into a rancher who was just kind of chatting with us at a gas station and mentioned how there used to be dozens of them around the gut piles on this one farm in the area. And we got back in the car, and Kirkland went, "I've never heard of that before in my life." And it just really spoke to the fact that, you know, there's a lot that we're still learning. That's where that quote came from. Like, there's a lot we don't know, and we're learning as we go. And that was really interesting to hear that, because I had never heard of California condors even being in this area before.
I want to move on to some other things, but I guess hopefully this is a one-off. Avian flu really hit the condor.
Oh
I mean,
yeah,
really
hopefully it is
hit
a
it
one-off.
hard. Yeah.
Yeah, it did. It was it reduced the southwest flock in Arizona and Utah to about one-fifth of its original size at that point last year, which was really bad and really emotionally tolling for the biologists with the Peregrine Fund and others who are in that area working with that flock. Yeah, avian flu, you know, has been an issue in other birds. They were not expecting it to hit California condors, but it was also the first animal to receive an avian flu vaccine, an emergency vaccine. So that was cool and historic for that to happen. And so far, so good this year. There haven't been any other cases. But of course, now there's avian flu in dairy cattle. So that's a concern for the condor biologists as well, because they will, that stillborn dairy calves are condor treats. So they're hoping that it doesn't, you know, affect the population that way. But yeah, so far so good. Hopefully it was a one-off. It was a very traumatic event for the biologists and the condors alike.
Yeah. Finally, we're not necessarily here to raise money or whatever, but it occurs to me our listeners, might have been listening to us, and some of them may think, "Hey, how can I help?" I don't know, any ideas on that front?
Totally. Yeah, it's a great question. There's a lot of different organizations who are working with California condors, many of which are nonprofits. So if you're interested in looking more into their work, the one organization that featured the most prominently in this story is the Peregrine Fund, because they're working directly with the Southwest Flock in Arizona and Southern Utah. But there's also a lot more nonprofits out there that are also working on this. Ventana Wildlife Society in California is also working on this. And so if you want to look into those organizations and you know, see the work that they're up to and donate to those organizations by all means. But also just, I think, like in conservation, talking about these things is one of the most powerful things you can do. You know, in a world where misinformation is so rampant now, I think being diligent about helping spread the factual information is goes a very long way in helping. And so if you're in conversation with someone and, you know, something similar comes up in conversation and you want to mention the California condor and talk a little bit about its story, I think that's great. And even more so than that, with this story in particular, encouraging people to not use lead bullets, that's probably the number one thing that you can do to help. So
thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with the writer Marlo Starling. She's a freelance journalist who writes about climate, conservation, and culture. You can find her at marlostarling.com. Marla Starling, I was fascinated by your article about lab-grown meats. Some governments are banning these meats now. Florida, Alabama, Italy has banned lab-grown meats. Before I read your article, I can't even describe my understanding of lab-grown meat as vague. I was people would be wondering, what is lab-grown meat?
Yeah, thanks for asking that up front, because it can be a little bit confusing. We've got Beyond Burgers and Veggie Burgers and other, you know, non-meat alternatives out there. But what lab-grown meat is essentially, chemically, it's almost identical to real meat. What it is cell-cultured meat, which isn't an explanation still, but basically you're taking the cells from a live animal and growing those in a lab setting into the form of meat that you are trying to market. So instead of it being like a cut of meat that's taken away from an animal via, you know, slaughterhouses, which is how our meat is currently produced from live animals, it's still taken from a live animal, but it's just the cells. And then it is grown into either, you know, we don't have steak yet, but like burgers or a chicken nugget or whatever form of meat you want to then sell. It's just kind of from point A to point Z way quicker than more direct, I guess, than you know, typical agriculture. It's still an evolving science, which is why it's kind of like a mystery to people. I also learned a lot working on this story that I didn't realize before about it, and how that like growth process happens is they have like a scaffolding agent of some sort that's completely, you know, like organic. Like one of the common ways is, I shouldn't say common, but one of the ways that they're exploring is by using a spinach leaf as the scaffolding to, you know, use to then grow the cells around that into that burger or chicken nugget or whatever it might be.
Hmm. So essentially meat, you know,
it is, yeah.
Very similar to what you do get from off the ranch, except it's grown in the lab. Okay. Right. So what's the beef, if I could be punny there for a minute? Governor DeSantis signed Senate Bill 1084, makes it illegal to sell, distribute, create, or possess lab-grown meat. I could see ranchers behind this, right? Do they really see this as competition?
Yeah, I think where to start? There's a lot of misinformation about the lab-grown meat industry and what proponents of it are trying to do. Governor DeSantis in Florida introduced this as something that is intended to push out traditional, you know, ranch-grown meat. When that is not, in fact, the case, there is no large scheme plan to push out the ranching industry or to dig into, you know, what ranchers are doing. It's an alternative to ranch grown meat, to kind of reduce our global emissions. So agriculture contributes a significant, portion of greenhouse gas emissions, which is the cause of global climate change. And so if we're able to reduce those emissions a bit, that would really help us in the long run. And so that's kind of the purpose of lab-grown meat in the first place, is as a climate solution, as a sustainability measure. And, you know, a lot of other folks are saying this is an entire industry that is being excluded now, you know, that could really have the potential to grow. It's at the stage it's at now, it does not appear to have any real competition with cattle ranching. Cattle ranching is so huge across the U.S. and elsewhere in the world. And the lab-grown meat industry is kind of just budding now. So that's one of the reasons. There's a lot of political conspiracy theory stuff going on with this, this one conspiracy theory that's kind of known as the Great Reset, that in part has to do with thinking that Bill Gates is trying to take over the world and force everyone to eat insects. Again, not what's happening. Insects have not even become like a protein alternative. There are certain cultures around the world that do eat insects, by the way. But that's not something that's trying to be pushed here in the US, and not something that's being marketed. So there's a lot of tidbits of misinformation here and there going on that are kind of villainizing lab-grown meat in a way that is excluding an industry and also excluding a climate solution, especially in a place like Florida, where I'm a born and raised Floridian. I'm from Miami, and sea level rise is actively happening, and temperatures are rising, and weird things are happening that are very concerning to our environment that will ultimately affect us down the road if they're not already affecting us, and they are. So, yeah.
I was interested in one of that. I think it's a farmer talking about this. I could see this would be effective, at least at this point, where we're all just learning what lab-grown meat is. He said, "Hey, you know what getting beef from my farm would be, right? And who knows what that is that comes out of the lab, right?"
Right. Yeah, and I really appreciated that Dusty Hawley with the Florida Cattlemen's Association spoke with me for this story, because I mean I can sympathize with that, right? There's an industry that you and your family have been part of for generations, and all of a sudden this other thing that is the same product really that you've been creating for generations is coming in and saying that it's the same thing when we don't really fully understand what the process is or how it's made. And so there is a lot of misunderstanding about what lab-grown meat is, which we addressed, earlier, but also how it's made and why it is indeed meat, right? And there's this big rift right now with not wanting to call lab-grown meat meat of any sort, saying it is not meat when it is exactly meat chemically. So there's a lot of, I think, mistrust there. And one of my other sources even told me, he said, we as scientists who are in the process of developing this and making it into something that's actually viable for people to eat, we need to do a better job of communicating this as well. It's not, all on everybody else. Like, we need to help people understand that this is safe, that it's not causing turbo cancers. That's another common misconception that kind of a rumor that got out into social media and spread like wildfire. I think that rumor was in part inspired by the way that these cells are cultured. They start with a few cells and then they grow and grow and grow until they become this product that you're aiming for. And to be fair, the intricacies of how that's done and how it's shaped properly are beyond the scope of my reporting for the story. I learned a little bit about it, enough to understand how that process works, but not at the very like nitty-gritty level. So it really is amazing that they're able to do what they can with this emerging like meat type. But yeah, I mean, so there's a lot of, I think that the whole idea of like these cells growing on their own, so to speak, is a little bit unsettling to people because people think, well, that's how cancer cells grow. And yeah, cancer cells do grow out of control, but this isn't causing cancer in any way. So yeah, I mean, it is a little bit of it's something new that people aren't familiar with, and to a cattle rancher who is raising animals for a living, I can see how that's a little bit of an unsettling or upsetting thing when you've had standards that you're following for a while. But also at the same time, the lab-grown meat industry is highly regulated right now. There's only two companies that have been authorized to sell lab-grown meat in the US. And there's others that are trying to get to that point, but the FDA has already implemented a set of standards to regulate that industry, make sure that it's all following regulations the same way that cattle ranchers have to follow regulations. And it's really difficult to achieve that like lab atmosphere that's sterile enough to produce lab-grown meat. There's still a lot of obstacles to making the industry more viable than it is currently. So it's still definitely not something that's like, this is a catch-all solution. It's never going to be a catch-all solution, but it can be one component to the overall solution.
Very interesting. I should mention this is in Sentient Media. You can find it at
Yes.
sentientmedia.org, and you can find it in all these articles at MarloStarling.com. We've been talking with writer Marlo Starling. You can find her, as I mentioned, MarloStarling.com. The article on the Condor, you can find it at Deseret.com, and that appeared in the June 2024 issue of Deseret Magazine. Marlo Starling, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Likewise. Thank you for having me. This was fun to chat with you.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.
Every rural person and place has a story. Change is part of that story. Rural Utah at a Crossroads is part of the Smithsonian Traveling Exhibit Crossroads, Change in Rural America, which explores the changing meaning of rural life and identity. Utah Humanities is touring Crossroads to 8 rural communities across Utah in 2024. As part of the tour, Utah Humanities and Utah Public Radio are partnering with exhibition hosts to interview local residents about change in their communities. This interview was recorded at the Wasatch County Library in Heber City, Utah.
My name is Catherine Berg, and I was born and raised in Heber. All my life, I've lived in rural Utah. I started teaching at Richfield High School, and I was the physical education teacher, and I taught there for 2 years. And then I moved to Orem Alpine School District. I loved that district. I taught at Orem Junior High for 7 years, and then I went to Cedar City and became associated with Southern Utah University, and I was there for 33 years. And there, I was a coach. I coached everything because that's when everything started for women. And then I was, from the beginning, I was over women's athletics. And later on, I became the associate director of athletics over all sports, except I never was over men's basketball. It was hard for the football coaches to have me kind of in charge and directing them occasionally. But I had great opportunities. The last sport that I coached was women's gymnastics, but I had the opportunity to coach basically everything in the women's program. There weren't very many, concessions made for women to do anything. And in the beginning, the kids paid their way. We had one set of uniform for team sports. We had one set of warm-ups. We practiced in the beginning. I was the coach. I taught a full day. We'd start practicing one sport at 6 o'clock in the morning because there was usually two going a season. Then we'd begin our second practice after open recreation, which meant mainly men, at 9 o'clock at night. So my days were pretty long. Changing minds is tough. Money is slim. Splitting money up so all can have the opportunity was really, really hard. But it happened, and it's better, but not complete yet. And it won't be in my lifetime, I'm sure. But it's about 900% better. It's just as meaningful and as important for them as it is for the young boys. Absolutely is. Gives them opportunities to develop skills, to develop social skills, to develop leadership skills, to develop skills that will help them in their careers. I have had the opportunity, not so much in Richfield, I was just 21, but everywhere else I have taught, I've had the opportunity to work in city or county government as on a committee or being actively engaged in something. So to be able to participate and to see change and to have a say on even a limited basis on how some of that change was coming about has been a great thing. And I'm grateful for that. I'm really an optimistic person thinking that things will come along and things will change. Things will be good because this is such a beautiful place. People here are beautiful. We've had a surge of people moving in. And a lot of times, people moving in bring things with them, both good and not so good. And that brings enrichment. So we don't want to lose that, but we want to maintain who we are. I hope we continue to grow in love and congeniality and services that will bless and strengthen people and be a place for people who want to come to recreate, because it is a recreation tourist place now, but that we do those things with I don't know whether you call it panache or what, but just do it well. I really hope that.
Rural Utah at a Crossroads is produced by Maya Shumway. It is a collaboration between Utah Public Radio, Utah Humanities, and the community hosts of Crossroads, Change in Rural America, a Smithsonian Museum on Main Street exhibition made possible in the Beehive State by Utah Humanities. Support for Museum on Main Street has been provided by the United States Congress. Broadcasts of rural Utah at a crossroads on UPR is supported by our members,